This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. When Jim Goodman was in the fourth grade, his family was the first on the block to own a television. It was one of those round picture tube jobs. And the very day they got it, his mom invited the whole fourth grade class over to their house to watch the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II. Well, this was the first of many formative memories that revolve around broadcasting. Jim's grandfather founded Capital Broadcasting Company in the 1930s, and Jim grew up alongside the business. He watched WRAL expand throughout the state, started broadcasting in color, and turned into a prominent player in the news business in the Southeast. After a brief stint in the military, Jim joined the family business, and he's now served as the president and CEO for almost four decades. But his career doesn't stop there. Since the early 1990s, he's been one of the primary champions of the revitalization of Durham. Capital Broadcasting Company bought the Durham Bulls and built the new ballpark, and Jim led the effort to develop the American Tobacco Historic District, where we sit right now. Jim Goodman is with me in the studio today to talk about his life and work and his thoughts on the state of North Carolina today. Jim Goodman, welcome. Good to have you here.
Frank, thank you for having me. One thing I always show people when I give them a tour of American Tobacco, we go into Bay 7,
yeah,
and we look into your studio here. So it's really something for me to be sitting here.
That's great. Well, and we should, in the interest of full disclosure, we should point out that you are a longtime and generous supporter of WUNC. So I just want to say that and make sure that that's all clear. But
okay,
take us back now. You grew up in Raleigh on Glenwood Avenue. Tell us a bit about your early years.
Glenwood Avenue, 909 Glenwood Avenue, is next to the Methodist Orphanage. I went to Lewis School, a small school on Devereaux Street. I then went to Daniels Junior High, first year Daniels opened. And I went to, then I went to Broughton. And I can't think of any great things about going to Broughton and stuff, and that being in high school in Raleigh, graduated in 61. I don't have anything, but maybe I was worried about who I was going to take to the prom or something, but that was a...
Now, interesting.
There was none of this drugs, terrorism, crime, stuff. It was just an idyllic time.
Or so it seems now in hindsight.
In hindsight.
Your grandparents lived... Well, and I should point out now, you went to Broughton. It was before integration.
Yes.
This is that time. What is your sense? I mean, you are obviously, you know, a white man. You come from some kind of a privileged background. And
yes,
at the time, that's the air you breathe. It's the ground you walk on.
Right.
Did you have any awareness at that time as a young man growing up?
You know, no. Yeah. No. I mean, it's just something that we didn't talk about and wasn't part of... what was going on. I mean, I'm ashamed of that. I mean, I'm not happy about that. You know, I remember when I read Tim Tyson's Blood Done Signed My Name and all that stuff that was going on and later and around, and that I wasn't aware of it. I didn't.
Yeah. I mean, that was right up the road in Oxford,
yeah,
North Carolina.
Right up in Oxford. So, so there was, I'm ashamed of that, but it was just the life we lived.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, your grandparents lived with you. You got to see the ins and outs of the company, WRAL's development. Tell us about your grandfather founding that, at first a radio station, right?
Yes. Okay. So this is a very interesting story. My grandfather had three sons and a daughter. The daughter, A.J. Fletcher's daughter, is my mother. One son was a lawyer and went to Washington, D.C., and went to work for the Federal Radio Commission.
Mm-hmm.
That was before the FCC. That was before there were radio stations. And so he talked his dad into doing this new thing, radio, and putting a radio station on the air. And he did, maybe 33, I'm not, in the 30s, mm-hmm. WRAL AM. It was a 1,000 watts daytime, 250 watts at night. You could not pick it up around the corner. But we had WRAL radio, and my uncle, Frank Fletcher, also got a lot of other people in North Carolina into the radio business, including my uncle, another uncle, Floyd, who lived here in Durham, who had WTIK radio.
So they were in competition.
They were in competition.
What was the sense of, you know, the landscape in terms of the hopes and the profitability of broadcasting in those early days? Was there
no? I mean, it was It was a low budget, low margin.
Yeah.
The most. So my uncle Fred was the morning guy on WRAL radio AM. Now Fred was the head of the Raleigh Recreation Commission for 40 years. He was a community guy. He wanted Raleigh to do well. I learned a lot from Fred. He was, it was very much a community oriented. We would call the hospital, all the births last night.
Yeah.
Call the jail who's in jail. It was community radio. Now, so here's radio, AM. Here comes FM. There was a lot of excitement about FM because no static. Better coverage, no static, better fidelity. Frank got the family into the FM business, and then comes television. I remember discussions that television is going to put radio out of business. This is not a good thing. But anyhow, the family applied for the license in Raleigh. That was a big fight. Durham Life Insurance Company also applied for it. They had hearings in Washington, which comparative hearings, they call them, which application is the best, who will do the best job serving the public interest. I think our team was very much the underdog. We had a very small radio station. Durham Life had WPTF, big 50,000 watt. And I credit my uncle Frank, who was our attorney, and the people at WRAL for convincing the commission that we should have the license. And so we went on the air in December of 1956.
You were there. Tell us about that. How old were you and what was that like?
Well, let's see, 43. I was 13.
Uh-huh.
I remember hiding behind some racks. We signed on from a garage at the transmitter. Studio hadn't been built. And I draw a picture in my mind. I have a boyish enthusiasm for sending pictures through the air. I mean, I'm still amazed at what we do. I mean, I love it. I mean, it's just really amazing. So I've developed a real interest in broadcasting and how it works. You know, I come from the technical production, keep us on the air side, right. Not on the air side, I told you. And
you must have been in Wonderland, a 13-year-old boy with all that gizmology around you. Actually going to send pictures to
you. We had a chief engineer. His name was Virgil Duncan, and my grandfather asked him to take care of Jimmy whenever he's out there, and he did. I mean, he's a fellow I rode around with giving away antennas down in eastern North Carolina. See, we signed on as an NBC affiliate, and WITN in Washington, an NBC affiliate, was already on. So we had to get people to turn their antennas and to watch this market.
Well, how'd you do that? There had to be local programming then. Is that what we got?
Yes, local programming. Yeah. And we had NBC when we first came on. Right. But I think it was always local programming.
Yeah, I mean, that had to be the thing, the reason they would watch you and not the Washington station. So what about going around, what was that like handing out antennas to people?
We'd go up to a house. We'd drive down the road and go up to a house and ask them if they wanted an antenna. It was as simple as that.
I mean, it's kind of
cool. You can pick up this
Raleigh
station. Look, you can watch this
on your roof, and you got to get it.
Back then, wait a minute, there was no cable.
Yeah, that's true.
No satellite.
Yeah.
No nothing. If you watched television, it was.
So were people anxious to get it? They were happy to do it. They were going to climb their roof. They're going to do what they needed to do.
I mean, we want you to relate to the Raleigh market rather than Greenville, Washington, New Bern. And it was a big. And so as we got those counties. The counties were assigned to that other market. As we got those counties, our market grew.
Sure.
Frank, hold on here. Let's see. We used to be the 63rd largest broadcast market in the country.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the 70s. Okay. We're now 25th. I mean, nobody can. We're now the 25th market. Now, I hasten to add, Raleigh's not the 25th, and Durham's not the 25th, and Cary's not the 25th. You put us all together,
right.
We're the 25th.
The whole metro
area. And that's my big regional notion, you know, about being a region. So the market has grown. We're a top 25 market, and we're excited about future.
I mean, that's just because there are more people here,
yeah,
right? And then
yeah.
the question is, how do you keep them? But I want to go back to also one more memory, that fourth grade when you had the only TV on the block. What was that like, bringing the fourth graders in to watch? Of all things, the coronation.
Well,
but I guess
we could walk to school. I walked to Lewis School. We walked over to the house and watched it, and I don't know what we thought. I mean, of course, it was black and white. And they were round. The first TV sets were round sets. It was a Zenith set. And by the way, I had a wire recorder. This is before tape. I had a wire recorder. It was a little, you know, metallic wire. And I would listen to the political conventions on the radio and record them on my wire recorder and act like.
You were a real geek.
It was bad.
Jim Goodman, president and CEO of Capital Broadcasting Company, owner of the Durham Bulls, developers of American Tobacco. We'll continue our conversation with him just ahead on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, which is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest is Jim Goodman. He helped develop this place, also president and CEO of Capital Broadcasting Company for almost four decades, led the effort to revitalize Durham through building the new Durham Bulls Stadium and developing American Tobacco. So we were talking about the fact that you were kind of a tech geek from an early time. You watched your grandfather build this broadcast company, and eventually you went to Duke to study engineering, right?
I went to Duke, after Broughton. My freshman year, I was a physics major.
How'd that go?
That didn't go too well.
Okay.
but, I wanted to be connected to broadcasting, and I thought electrical engineering was the way to do that. And in my third year of engineering, it had been a struggle. I remember it. Like it was yesterday. I had a lab on Monday night, about 9 o'clock, walking back to the dorm. It was cold. I had no, I wasn't doing well. I didn't have a lot of interest. And I said, you know, this ain't going to work. So I left Duke. I'd completed all of my basic courses. I was just in my major and joined the Navy, to see the world. Mm-hmm. And I did boot camp in San Diego. I was then assigned to the Naval Air Station in Memphis, Tennessee, believe it or not, largest inland naval air station in the world, 25,000 sailors there. And I became a what they call a training device, operated link training, link simulators, computer simulators for flying. And I spent 3 years in the Navy there, being very hard on myself about school.
Were you still interested in broadcasting at the
time?
Oh,
yeah.
Because
you
were moonlighting at a television station there,
yes,
too, right?
While I was in the Navy, I worked for WHBQ in Memphis, the ABC affiliate. Mm-hmm. No. I was still very interested in broadcasting. And so that's where I met Barbara.
Tell us about meeting Barbara, your wife.
Here's the story I like to tell.
All right. We have Barbara in a soundproof booth.
No, here's a story I like to tell. I mean, I'm one of 25,000 sailors out at this Naval Air Station, and the USO would bring busloads of girls out every weekend. And she stepped off the bus, and it was love at first sight. Now, Barbara would never go to a USO dance. She gets really mad when I say that. I had a guy in my squadron dated Barbara's roommate. That's how I met her.
All right.
And the rest... that's the best thing ever happened to me. So I'm very excited. I'm very happy about my experience in the Navy. And
while you were there at that TV station, you were working in Memphis, and you were there working the night Martin Luther King was shot.
You know, they had a. I was on the night shift studio engineer, and it's right after supper. I got a call from the newsroom there at WHBQ, and they said one of their highway patrol radios wasn't working. Jim, can you come down and see what you can do? Everybody had gone to supper. Mm-hmm. We had booth announcers. We had live announcer. So I went down to the newsroom, and I heard on the Mississippi Highway Patrol radio, Arkansas. You know, that's Arkansas, Mississippi, and Tennessee right there in the corner. We had all three.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Radios. I heard on the Mississippi Highway Patrol radio, attention all cars, Dr. King has been shot. We just had the garbage strike. We were an ABC station. The ABC news people had been there doing feeds and stuff. They just left. They'd left the day before. So I ran across the street, a grill across the street. Charlie B. Watson was the name of our booth announcer. And I got Charlie to come over. And I said, Charlie, you got to come down and listen to this. If we can verify this, we need to put it on the air. I believe that we were the first station in Memphis to put that on the air. I can't prove it, but I enjoy saying it. I then called WRAL-TV, and I also argued that WRAL-TV was the second station in the country to announce that Dr. King had been shot. Yeah.
Wow. So you were in Memphis, and eventually you moved back to Raleigh.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that, because then you started working in operations.
Yeah, I came, moved back to Raleigh and went to working at the station in production and operations and programming, and have continued that emphasis in the management side for 40 years.
You were working under a famous broadcaster at the time, a guy by the name of Jesse Helms.
Yes. Senator Helms was executive. So my uncle Fred was president. My grandfather was chairman. My uncle Fred Fletcher was president, and Senator Helms was executive vice president. And Senator Helms had operations, so I worked directly for him. You know, Frank, we did a 5-minute editorial. We couldn't do sports on the 6 o'clock news because we didn't have time. He would come in every morning and write a 5-minute.
Oh, yeah. Those became kind of famous, or should I say infamous?
Write a 5-minute editorial, so I could really only see him in the afternoons if I saw him. When I discussed that, he was a very nice person, very good person to work for, gave me a lot of room. There were a few things that I knew I shouldn't do. He gave me a lot of room, and he was very supportive of my career in the company. Mm-hmm. I was, I hasten to add that I wasn't on the editorial board and didn't have anything to do with it, except when we recorded them every day, I had to get the building quiet.
I see.
So the studio was quiet when we recorded them.
Well, I mean, I take your point. He may have been a swell guy to work with,
and
all of that. But you have to say, you have to admit, he did say some fairly hateful things that have
destructive. Well, Frank, I really loved my grandfather. Mm-hmm. I lived first 5 years of my life. I grew up with my grandparents. I don't remember a single anything other than great feelings about my grandfather. Now, I have to process that Jesse Helms was on the station and said what he said because my grandfather wanted him to. Mm. Right?
Mm.
I believe that's why my grandfather wanted to be in the television business. He really wanted to counter the Daniels and the News and Observer editorial policy, and he and what was really a courageous thing, broadcasting stations hadn't done that before. Put Senator Helms on the air, and there you go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think
people still say to me, "Oh, you work for the Jesse Helms station," and I say, "Well, gosh, he was in the Senate 30 some years. I mean, hadn't been here in a while."
But I mean, I think this is the complicated thing, and just hearing you do this now a couple of times is in some ways a demonstration of what's going on today in public discourse. We hear there's so much tension, particularly over race. Let's stick with that for a moment. And the question of what to do about privilege. And, you know, it's one thing to walk away from it and say, well, it's not my problem, somebody else's. But I think to do what you're doing, which is to say, look, this is a complicated relationship. I love my grandfather. He may have had ideas that I don't support, but I can't not love my grandfather.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Who can not love their grandfather, right?
Right. And so it's a tough...
Yeah.
Right, it's a tough. He was my grandfather was Beverly Lakes' law partner.
Yeah. Wow,
the last segregationist candidate.
Yeah.
For governor, and Dr. Lake was one of the nicest people you'll ever run into. Okay, I don't. I'm acting like I need therapy, but I'm
no,
okay.
No, but I mean, I think
I'm,
that's.
I'm okay. I mean,
because your views on race, I mean, and gender are certainly far different. I mean, we're going to talk a little bit more in this segment about where things have gone in the state of North Carolina, and I know that you have some very serious reservations about where things are headed, particularly because of some of the racist and homophobic policies that have come from the North Carolina legislature and the governor. Talk more about the just working relationship, working with your family, all these family members. Is a lot of tension? I mean, how does that go? That's hard to do.
Well, you know, continuing it along the sort of not so pleasant track here. So my grandfather decided that he would tell the family what his plans are for the future of the company, and those plans were that I would have the majority vote. And there were members of the family who were hurt, didn't understand it, and that happened.
And nonetheless, you became CEO, and you
had to, no. So I mean, you know, people say, "Well, why did your grandfather do that?" And I'm saying, "Well, you know, you really need to ask him." I mean, he decided how he wanted it in the future. He laid it out. He laid it out before he died, and at his death, I majority stock. My brother is also a stockholder, and. Off we went. I mean, that's a true thing just happened.
Well, you helped bring the company into the digital age. Before that, you worked with legendary news anchor Charles Gaddy.
Charlie Gaddy.
Yeah. So, yeah, tell us about Charlie, because he really was a legend in this area.
Charlie Gaddy. So my grandmother died. Elizabeth Utley Fletcher died. My grandfather remarried. And she listened to a program on WPTF called Ask Your Neighbor. And Ask Your Neighbor was you would call up and say, you know, I have a lawnmower for sale, call this number, or I would like to buy this. I mean, it was horrible.
The swap
shop. It was terrible.
Yes.
I mean, don't tell Charlie I said that. So my grandfather called me in the office one day and said, you know, Margaret likes this boy, Charlie Gaddy at WPTF, and I would like for you to do Ask Your Neighbor. I'd like for you to hire Charlie and do Ask Your Neighbor on television. Well, I was mortified. But I'm a, you know, I'm on the team. And so hired Charlie. We did a show with Good Morning Charlie. Mm-hmm. He was sitting in an auditorium and people could call up and talk to him. Now, the right away, it was clear that Charlie's a remarkable, not only a remarkable person and a great citizen, and but a really terrific talent. So right away, we worked to get him into news. And as they say, the rest is history. I need to thank
See, because he made that thing work. I mean, the fact is, you got to imagine this is the worst thing you could possibly do for a station, and it works.
Here we go.
Because people like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So now we're talking about broadcasting, and you've obviously you've been interested in the cutting edge. You helped bring the company into the digital age, right? And I guess you worked with the Gore Commission as well. Tell us.
Yeah,
about
you know,
that.
There's a lot we've gone through. I have a couple of overriding theories of business, Frank, and one that I think is really important is first to market. Right, if there's something new, do it. Might work, might not work, but if it does work, and you're recognized as first to market, that's you're always that. So I've always been interested in new technology. I'm very interested in how it can help us do a better job in producing programming and doing the news. So we've consistently in almost every area, we've first videotape, first helicopter, digital, new transmission systems, that kind of stuff is very important. Now, as long as I've been in Broadcasting, there's been an argument about how many stations can you own. And along with that argument continues, what public interest responsibilities do stations have? You know, we don't own the license. We're allowed to operate on that channel, and the question is, what are our obligations in return for the license? And that's been a continuing, my side's lost.
A lot of consolidation.
It used to be you could only own three stations.
Especially
we
in the 80s.
People that 70 television stations.
Right.
We have very few public interest requirements.
Right.
But anyhow, we made a big stab at establishing public interest requirements with the Gore Commission. We weren't successful, but I think that what in the discussions, a lot of people from all over the country, I think that we did stop some ownership rulemaking at the commissions. We slowed it now.
Yeah.
But we sort of sell them and trade them like pork bellies or something.
Well, it's corporate.
They're owned by equity firms and stuff like that, and equity players. So we lost, and that is a particular problem for us. You know, we have this one market. And so if you own 50 markets and you're trying to buy a program from a company, and you own one market and you're trying to buy a program from the same company, you're at a significant
disadvantage. And yet if you talk about public interest, the idea that that station planted in that place with that family that owns it has a much bigger stake and a much better understanding than the equity shareholders who are on Wall Street, who don't really care what's going on in your community and never will.
But that's precisely the reason we switched to NBC. Because we've got a long-term agreement with NBC. They still have people that are very supportive of local broadcasting. And I felt like...
They're owned by General Electric, aren't they?
No, they're by Comcast.
Comcast, sorry.
I know. Hold on. The president was down here last week and...
A big company.
Big company, but he understands broadcasting. And I believe that we can be WRAL is what I'm saying.
All right. Well, we'll stay tuned.
So you watch today?
Stay tuned on that. I listen to a lot of radio, Jim.
Okay, well.
I'm just saying.
hold on. Lester Holt at 6:30 at NBC News? Good.
All right.
Good. Watching.
Right. You got to stop doing commercials. Right now. All right. I want to talk about, broadcasting your life. You're kind of geeky. You like technology. Yep. You want to be on the cutting edge. What brings you into the real estate business and, for of all things, buying the Durham Bulls?
I became aware of this Raleigh, Durham, Cary, Chapel Hill, this wonderful region, and our inability to work together. And really the competitive nature between what was going on. We did the U.S. Olympic Festival, 87, and we had all the chambers working together. We had 12,000 volunteers. We had all the universities working together. It was a sort of mind-altering thing for me. And I said, you know, the way we really get this triangle together is to have a sports complex out by the airport. We're going to call it Triangle Central Park, and we're going to build a ballpark for the Bulls. We're going to build the arena. We're going to build a convention center. We're going to do this. We're all going to play for it, and we're all going to own it, and we'll all, you know, stroll down the lane hand in hand, and this is going to be wonderful.
And the ballpark in the airport area, because why? It borders all three?
The airport's probably the best example of regional cooperation. Yeah. And I optioned land that was in Durham County and Wake County and in Cary. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was nobody could object to it. And I've got legislation through the legislature. I really worked hard on that. Now, I had no notion of owning anything. I believed that Miles Wolf, a good friend, owner of the Bulls, had agreed to move his team to Triangle Central Park. We had actually put the plans out for bid. We had selected a contractor, and we were ready to go. Now, remember, Durham did not like the Triangle Central Park plan. They didn't want the Bulls to leave downtown Durham. they had a bond election to build a new park and to do a new ballpark and to do some stuff downtown, and that failed.
Right.
So I was thinking, off we go.
Sure. I mean, the people of the county had said, we don't want this thing.
We don't want this new ballpark. We're not going to fund it. So
you got the deal
now
together.
The mayor of Durham and the mayor of Raleigh were very good friends. You know, our mayor of Raleigh, Avery Upchurch, is the nicest person in the world. I mean, he's just a wonderful guy, and he was worried. He didn't want the Durham folks mad at him. So he said to me, he said, Jim, you know, here's what I'm going to say publicly. I'm going to say, you're opposing this ballpark, but you voted against it. So you don't have any standing to oppose this ballpark. I'm willing to build a park at Triangle Central Park. So
we're going to get the rest of that story. We're going to take a break.
All right.
And then we're
going to
get the rest of the story, how the Durham Bulls, the city of Durham, kept the Durham Bulls in Durham, with my guest, Jim Goodman, president and CEO of Capital Broadcasting Company for over almost four decades now. The conversation continues on the State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Jim Goodman today, president and CEO of Capital Broadcasting Company, a business that owns the Durham Bulls, built American Tobacco Historic District, and we should point out is a generous supporter of WUNC as well. We will do that in the interest of full disclosure. So talk about this now. The Durham County voters reject a bond issue that would have helped build a stadium, so it's not coming to Durham at this point. You've got the land and pretty much the whole deal put together. The owner of the Durham Bulls says, I will move out to this Triangle sports facility. I'll move the team. Everything's in place to move the team out there.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's a caveat. Okay, well, that's close. That's close enough.
Okay.
Anyhow, when the bond issue failed, Miles, I think, was very frustrated.
Miles is the
Wolf, the owner of the Bulls.
And
my feeling was that I needed an anchor tenant. It had to be the Durham Bulls, and the only way I could be sure that the owner would move them if I was the owner. So I talked Miles into selling me the team. So here I am with the Durham Bulls. Now, hold on. This is what the story I was telling you. So the Raleigh mayor said to the Durham mayor, look, stop fussing at us. You voted against this ballpark. We're willing to build one. Cool it. Now, I tell you what we'll do. We'll give you 30 days to come up with a plan for you to build a ballpark in Durham, and we will not do Triangle Central Park. That was a strategy. Everybody believed that Durham was going to say no. They would stop fussing about it, and we would do Triangle Central Park. In just a few days, the Durham City Council came up with a plan. I believe I'm right about this, Frank, to mortgage the water and sewer plant, and to build a new ballpark in downtown Durham. And we were all surprised. Now, you know, I'm good with play the cards you're dealt. I mean, that. Mm-hmm. And working with Durham to build the new ballpark has been a great partnership, and we built the best AAA ballpark.
That's
worked out fine. That's Durham's ballpark, remember?
Right.
Durham built the ballpark. Now, we also put money in the ballpark, but it's Durham's ballpark, and that Durham's never said they'll do something they haven't done. I mean, tell you if they're not going to do it.
But here's an interesting part of the story, I think, and I need you to tell it because, so the mayor of Raleigh says, I need some cover here. I don't want to look like I'm stealing from poor little Durham, so I'm going to give them 30 days. I know they can't come up with it, but I'll at least say I've tried. And then they come up with the money. The city council and the mayor come up with a way to get the money outside of the bond referendum that failed. And what happened to them? They all got voted.
Chuck Grubb passed away lately.
Yeah.
Yes, they were voted off.
Yeah, I mean, the voters were serious about this.
The voters were mad about it.
We're not giving away money to developers.
By the way, I can't find anybody that was against the ballpark. Can you?
Not now. Not now. But now tell me, so from a business point of view, the idea coming to downtown Durham in 1995, I mean, really, as a business person, it seems to me a lot of folks were not very hopeful about this city.
Yes. I take over the Bulls immediately. So I have a few years in the old ballpark, and that was rough. That was that was really a rough go. The first night, I get my numbers wrong, it was like 15 windshields.
Oof. Mm-hmm.
Bricked.
Yeah.
Right. And then we had to work on, we got all that done. So we took everything one at the time. We built a great ballpark, and I believe that we, the city and the Bulls and Capitol, developed a lot of confidence in each other and that we would do what we say we'd do. And I committed at that time that, okay, now here's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to see if I can help you get a payoff from this investment in downtown Durham. The first part of that was Diamond View One, and that went very well. I couldn't help but see American Tobacco coming into the game.
The interesting thing is these tenants are moving in. I mean, talk about some of the big tenants, and then, of course, the underground here at American Tobacco, which was the next the next phase.
Yeah, the next phase was American Tobacco, and then we later did Diamond View 2 and Diamond View 3. The important part of this is, so the idea, well, I got an option on American Tobacco, a long option, because I knew it was going to take a long time. Right. And so we made a list of things. We got the city and the county to agree to a parking deck if we could get it done. Their decks, we pay rent. And I got corporations, Duke being the first one, Glaxo, McKinney. I got several corporations to agree to lease space if we could get it done. And so we learned about historic tax credits. We learned about new market tax credits. We took our time and, daggone, we got it done.
Got it done. It's all here. And these businesses are, why do you think?
With a lot of help. Now, I need to talk about all the help we got. And I've been working on what really happened with American Tobacco. And I am Jim Goodman, I am going to take the credit for unleashing the potential of Durham, which had been closed up in a box. Durham did not have a very high regard for itself.
But
I think that's I think that's what leadership is you show other people what they're capable of doing and what happens if you improve and you improve and you improve. And all of that potential and everything was here in Durham ready to roll.
But how much of that do you think is the fact that you're a businessman and you're talking to other businesses about moving in? So it's one thing to talk to, the Economic Development Commission or maybe some politicians or the mayor, but of course you always see them coming as a business person and you're trying to look around and see what they have going. But maybe you just spoke the language in a way that a business person could understand and they had a little more credibility in that community. I mean, they had to have enough confidence to actually move in here. That's the other thing.
Yes.
Right?
Well, I think they did have that confidence. Duke has made it a part of who they are is to help developers get started in downtown Durham. Glaxo was very supportive. CompuWare, Pete Carmanos, the owner of the Hurricanes, first job out of college was giving away Lucky Strikes on college campuses. He took a space the first time I showed him a building. So that worked, and I'm not surprised.
But there also has to be political will. There has to be, first of all, the government. Yes. Government is not the problem. In fact, government can be the answer.
Yes.
And politicians
have to
work together.
Public-private partnership. You're right.
You talked about tax credits, the ability to think creatively about how to use tax money and that sort of thing. So that was all, I guess, part of this thing, which brings us to your understanding of what's happened in North Carolina recently. The idea that this legislature thinks cutting taxes is the answer and that will build a strong business community and...
Before we went on, I mentioned to you that I sort of fancy myself as knowing something about economic development. I don't know. I've talked to 7,500 companies in the last 10 years trying to. By the way, if you're looking at coming to the Triangle, don't talk to me. I'll talk you into it. I mean, I'll get you here. I'm so excited about what's going on here in the Triangle. So I've met a lot of companies. I've met a lot of CEOs. I've met a lot of HR directors. And I think I know what they're looking for. And what they're looking for, the first thing they'll say, okay, this community we're going to be in, tell me about your education system. Tell me about the quality of life. You know, would my employees want to live here? Nobody's ever asked me about the unemployment insurance rate. And I can think.
Well, how about the corporate tax rate?
Yeah, I believe there's one. I can only remember one company. You know, by the way, they've already looked that up.
Well, right. apparently they were moving in here in big numbers when we were the 46th highest tax rate in the country, and they were coming in here. We were the fastest growing state in the country until recently.
I think that there is an intellectual argument here. I don't think it's political. I don't think it's liberal or conservative. I think it's a reasonable argument to make, and that is this, that the current legislature and governor support the notion that the key to the future is low taxes, low wages, and low skill. If you interpret everything that they've done, I believe that that is a fair analysis of what they've done. If you don't agree with that analysis, fine. Don't call me liberal or conservative or anything about it. I think that's a reasonable analysis of their party, of what they've done, of their program. I think it's investment in public education. I think it's quality of life. all of these other things that make it so great to live in the Triangle. You know, the governor did something that really, I'm a kind of a nut on leadership. And I've seen all the governors now in 40 years at Capital Broadcasting Company. And we've had some really great governors. The governor said right when he started that North Carolina has a bad brand. Those are the words of the CEO. And I had two big problems with that. One is, it's not true. I can't remember when we weren't in the top 5 to 10 places to do business. It wasn't factually true. I mean, all of the that we were really rolling. Yeah. And the second problem I had with it was, even if it were true, you know, the old man shouldn't be saying that. I mean, that's not how you get... That's not how you get the troops rolling, is to announce that we have a bad brand. So that I knew right then that my concept of being a business person or being a conservative or whatever you want to call it is return on investment. You know, being conservative doesn't mean don't spend any money. We've got to make the right investments in public education and infrastructure and all these other things in order for us to do what we want to do. Now, it is true now. If the governor got on and said we have a bad brand, it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
The state has slipped in all of those surveys that you talked about since this legislature has taken
I'm confident that he believes that what he's doing is the right thing to do. But I'm arguing that not from a political basis, but from how we're going to grow the state, it's not the right thing to do. So their notion is, stop me on this, but the governor and the legislature have defined themselves by what they don't like. They don't like the unemployed. They don't like people that want health insurance. They don't like gays. They don't like, there's this great long list of segments of the community that they don't like. And I don't think that's leadership. I mean, I look for the governor to be everybody's governor. He's the governor of the unemployed. Mm-hmm. But he's also the governor of transgendered people. I mean, he's the governor of everybody. But no, we got to talk about, Frank, I'll stop after this. We reduced unemployment benefits drastically. We should have reduced them some, not as much as we did. But if we had waited 6 months, there was a federal program that was supplying unemployment that, because we changed it when we did, was cut off. We cut off $300-400 million of federal.
Well, Medicaid, the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah. I don't know how you do that. I'm not. You don't need to hear me about that. The economic development.
Well, you're not alone, because the business community is outspoken in its backlash against HB2, which got passed in 48 hours without much debate at all. And the business community is saying, you're hurting us again. We're not going to be able to recruit good people to your state if you're anti-gay.
I thought it was an opportunity for the governor to be the governor. He should have said, hold it a minute. First of all, I'm not sure this is a problem. But secondly, you got all kinds of stuff in here that doesn't have anything to do with what we're talking about. So I'm going to veto this, and we'll talk about it in the short session. I mean, you look for the governor to not be part of the herd, but to slow everybody down and come up. So I'm very disappointed that he didn't do that.
I've got a couple of minutes left. I know you want to talk about the A.J. Fletcher Foundation.
Really?
Name for your, yeah, but let's talk about the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. Name
yes,
for your
okay. My grandfather my grandfather was an opera singer and a Shakespearean actor. He talks about hearing opera for the first time in the fifth grade. Started an opera company, the Grassroots Opera Company. Mm-hmm. We performed in the public schools of North Carolina, more than a million school children, and that started the foundation. When my grandfather died, he left a good bit of stock and assets to the foundation, and it has continued to grow. I've been chairman of that since my grandfather's death. We are involved in all kinds of things that I'm really proud of. We operate a school for LD kids. We are big supporters of public broadcasting. It goes on and on. We're very big supporters of Policy Watch and the Justice Center. So that is, you know, that's my, okay, family one.
Opera program at the North Carolina School of the Arts?
Yes. We moved the opera program to the School of the Arts. It's endowed there now, the A.J. Fletcher Opera Institute. So I mean, you know, so that the we have the company, we have the foundation, and we have the family. You know, I've got Frank. I need to put in a plug for our spark plug. Mom, Barbara. You know, I really love Barbara, and I love the family, and she keeps us all. Remember, she's got Jimmy's in the company, Michael's in the company.
Two boys working in the company.
Boys are working in the company, and so she keeps us all straight, and is very interested in the family herself, particularly with housing and alcohol rehabilitation and stuff. She's great. I wish we had more time.
Jim Goodman, CEO and president of Capital Broadcasting Company, and a generous friend of WUNC, I have to say, as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You can find out more about Jim at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton Orman. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.